are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide.
We're seeing a lot of ambitious claims from the government in terms of where mental health funding is going when it comes to schools. But as a frontline psychiatrist and dealing with teachers on a daily basis, I struggle to see where these resources are going.
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources, and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance, and research-based publications.
This is Holly, editor at Teacher Toolkit, the most influential blog on education in the UK. 2018 is the centenary of some women winning the right to vote in the UK. Here at Teacher Toolkit, we will be commemorating the anniversary by interviewing 100 women working in the field of education or in the public eye in order to catalogue their lives, celebrate their successes, find out what challenges they face, and discover what they would like to pass on to the next generation. In our 22nd interview for the 100 Women series, Ross McGill interviews Dr. Sarah Vora, a consultant child and adolescent psychiatrist who specialises in the mental health of children and young people. Listen to Sarah talk about the realities of working as a junior doctor, what made her follow a career in psychiatry, and how to spot the signs of children struggling with mental health problems. This episode also includes a fantastic practical strategy that you can implement in the classroom to help children signal to you that they are having a tough day without saying a word. Make sure you listen to the end of Ross and Sarah's chat to hear it.
Hello everyone, this is Ross at Teacher Talk at the most influential blog on education in the UK. Today I'm with Dr. Sarah Vora. I pronounced that
yes,
correctly?
Yes, you have, thank you.
Okay, fantastic. Could you just introduce yourself and tell us what you do?
Yeah, so my name's Dr. Sarah Vora. I'm a consultant child and adolescent psychiatrist. So I basically specialise in mental health of children and young people. So I deal with children literally from the age of zero right through to 18 and deal with a broad range of mental health conditions. So everything from depression, anxiety, eating disorders.
So I'd imagine you're quite busy. Could you describe a typical day for us?
Yeah, so I'm a full-time NHS consultant. I'm based in the community. So a typical day for me would be going to clinic. I start my clinic at 9 o'clock, finish at 5. And I tend to spend about an hour with each of my patients.
Right.
And I find that that's kind of long enough to be able to allow them to open up, but not too long that it feels quite intimidating and you lose the value of the session. And I can see people just routinely in clinic.
Yeah.
It might be that someone's presented to an A&E locally and I might have to go and see them in a more urgent setting. It might be that they're a risk to themselves or to other people, so it might warrant a more urgent assessment.
Okay.
Sometimes I go to police cells to see people, or I might go into schools as well to see people.
It sounds... You know, my background was 20 years in social services and Salvation Armies, and I saw drunkards and schizophrenics and prison cells and dead bodies and all sorts. So I can imagine the trauma you probably deal with yourself day to day. It'd be quite intense. So we'll come back to that. Could you tell listeners about your educational background, your own childhood at school?
Yeah, so I went to just a state primary school. I went to a grammar school. We ended up going to a grammar school about an hour away from where I lived, so it was a very long bus journey, but my parents were insistent that that's the school that we went to.
Okay.
And I did my GCSEs, did relatively well in those, and then went on to study all the sciences and English literature, actually, for my A-levels.
Okay, university?
Went to University of Leeds to study medicine, was there for 5 years. And then have been a doctor for the last 10 years, subspecialising in psychiatry
so
for the last 8 years.
So teaching never came across your thought process for a career?
No, regrettably, no.
So at what point did nursing then come up?
You mean being a doctor?
So in the field of medicine, when did that start?
So I think for me, well, my dad's a doctor, so I think I grew up in a household where that was definitely an influence.
Yeah.
My brother had gone on to medical school. So it just felt like quite a natural fit. I wouldn't say as go as far as saying my parents coerced me to go into medicine, but because I was around it and immersed in it, it just felt that something.
So, you know, the field of medicine is totally alien to me. Give me a summary highlight. What are the highlights of being a doctor and what are the possible downsides?
So I think people don't realise actually how hard you work as a junior doctor. Mm. So when I qualified from Leeds, you go into sort of general doctoring. So you need to go your house officer years, where you do rotations in medicine, surgery, possibly psychiatry. And you work incredibly long hours with very, very little reward, really. It can be incredibly exhausting and tiring. So I think people don't necessarily see what goes on behind the scenes. But it's very, very taxing, very taxing.
So that I guess the reward is the for the patient itself and seeing them through all the difficulties.
And the reason that I went into psychiatry is actually when I was in my junior doctor years and I was doing medicine, a lot of the time, unfortunately, patients were symptoms in the bed. So when I was working in a busy medical assessment unit, it would be the broken toe in bed two or the broken leg in bed five or the chesty cough in bed six. And I felt actually you lose the person.
Yeah.
Whereas with psychiatry, you would have people that would enter the medical assessment unit having overdosed, having self-harmed. And actually I was interested in learning actually what drove them to that point. And with psychiatry, you spend so much longer with your patients. Yeah. Everything's relevant from, you know, how they were brought up, how was their mum's mental health when they were carried during the pregnancy, what's their friendship circle like, what did family mealtimes look like, if they at all exist. And I found that actually that was more rewarding, rather than just being able to see something, you know, and being able to fix it. So my husband's a surgeon, so for him, his mindset's very much, something's broken, I fix it. Whereas I think with psychiatry, you have to be prepared that you're in it for the long haul and you're not often going to get a quick fix, but actually the value is getting to know someone inside and out.
And what career highlight, what are you most proud of in your career?
I think getting my consultant post, which I achieved this year, and I felt that that was just kind of a reflection of the years that I've put in, and also writing my book this year. And
I have a copy. The title is?
Mental Health in Children and Young People.
Okay, and give for listeners, if we put this on the blog and just signpost it for people, what could their teachers benefit from reading your book?
So it would be about learning to spot signs when a child's struggling with their mental health and thinking about potentially what might be going on for them. So is that child depressed? Are they struggling with an eating disorder? I have checklists at the end of each chapter to make things a little bit easier. And I also have communication tips, because we're seeing lots in the media about needing to improve the conversation around mental health. But actually, we all know, if I was to ask you, how are you? You'd most likely say, I'm fine, and we'd move past
on
that.
Very quickly,
Whereas actually what I've done within the book is provide a structure to conversations so that people are not just leaving it at the I'm fine and having the confidence to push the conversation forward.
Okay,
so if a child was to turn around to you and say, I'm fine,
giving
you a bit of a structure,
nice
to be
dialogue,
able to, yeah, absolutely.
A script a bit deeper.
Yeah.
And then to recognise potential signs.
Recognise potential signs and then knowing how to access that early support.
Okay, great. Well, I look forward to getting into the detail of all that. Now, I've got to ask you kind of two-pronged question here. I want to know one thing you'd change in education, but could I also throw in what one thing you'd change in the medicine world?
Okay. In education, I think this is based on my experience, is I would like to see mental health more at the forefront. I think we're seeing a lot of ambitious claims from the government in terms of where mental health funding is going when it comes to schools. But as a frontline psychiatrist and dealing with teachers on a daily basis, I struggle to see where these resources are going. And I think there's a real disparity up and down the country in terms of mental health resources. And this is just based on my own experiences going into school, where I still don't feel that teachers have the confidence or the resources to be able to speak about mental health confidently and be able to deal with potential fallouts when talking to a child about their mental health. So that would be the first thing, was just more funding for mental health resources in school, and actually being able to have time within my job plan to go into schools to be able to talk about that.
Is that the one thing you'd change in the medicine world?
I think so. I mean, there is some flexibility. Yeah, there is some flexibility in my day-to-day job. So I have what's called supported professional activity, which allows me to explore other areas related to my job that I'm interested in. So I do choose sort of public health as my supported professional activity, but there's not the consistency. Not every child psychiatrist will choose that as their activity. And what I would like to is almost make that mandatory, that actually you have to invest in the schools local to you and offer a teaching session once a week, okay. Once every couple of weeks.
Nice idea. Is there one piece of advice you would give to teachers? So we're in the 100 Women series here as a podcast. So if we focus on girls for a specific example, maybe talk about some of the ideas you've already got in your book. But what one piece of advice would you like teachers to pass on to the next generation of girls in schools?
I think if I'm talking about sort of communication and encouraging young girls to communicate, when I see a lot of young girls that come into my clinic, often they've been struggling with their emotional mental health for some time, and it's been passed off as being, oh, just typical teenage girl behaviour. Mm. And actually what I'd want to do is with teachers, encourage them to create a dialogue. Hello. From as soon as that girl starts at secondary school, even primary school. One of the things that I use, which is a really, really simple resource, is what I call the mental health traffic lights.
Okay.
And I would like to see this implemented in all schools. And it's about working out with a child, so a girl in this instance, what are things to be worried about? So, for instance, I tell girls to wear a bracelet, a red bracelet, yellow bracelet, or a green bracelet. Mm-hmm. A red bracelet might communicate to a teacher when she walks into the classroom that Amy's really struggling with her mental health today. She needs the teacher to do X, Y, and Z, or she needs the teacher to ask her this particular question. Mm-hmm. Amy might come in half an hour later wearing a green bracelet and say, actually, I'm okay with in terms of my mental health, and actually I can be left to get on with my work. Mm-hmm. And this works really well with children that
have struggled. Is anyone using that technique?
Yeah, so the children local to me, yeah. Okay. But that's based on me advising teachers on a particular student.
It's a fabulous, a very easy, but quite a fabulous
idea. So for instance, I've got a 14-year-old girl who really struggles with anxiety, and it typically arises when she's in the classroom. And the problem is, when she gets more and more anxious, she finds that she's less confident about alerting the teacher who's in the grips of a class. Mm-hmm. About her anxiety and the need for time out. Now, she's been given a time out card by the teacher, but doesn't have the confidence to utilise that. And the problem is her anxiety builds and builds and builds to the point that she develops a panic attack. She's short of breath, she's sweating, she's got chest tightness, and then the teacher, and as a result, she's drawing attention to herself, which feeds that vicious cycle of anxiety. So I worked closely with her and the teacher to utilise this bracelet system. Now, she knew as soon as her heart started racing that little bit faster, you know, her hands were clammy, mm-hmm. that she was probably on a red, that a panic attack was imminent.
Right.
And what she needs to do was get out of that classroom and access peer support or access mm-hmm. a timeout facility. So she would put on the red bracelet as soon as those early symptoms, would raise her hand, she wouldn't have to say anything to the teacher, but instantly she would see the red bracelet on her wrist and say, right, do you want to go and access peer support?
That's a fantastic idea.
And that works really well. It's really simple. It doesn't rely on the child, who often in those cases can't open up about how they're feeling. It doesn't rely on them to have to articulate
how
they're feeling.
Just a nice visual cue.
Absolutely.
In front of the peers.
Yeah.
Right, well, I think we're going to get that shared quite widely.
That's
a great idea.
So
the 100 women vote, the centenary, what does the vote mean to you? So the right for the women winning the right to vote.
I think, if I'm to speak in terms of my medical career, actually when I went into medical school, 70% of my year group were women,
right.
Which I think is phenomenal, actually. When I think about my father's generation, medicine was very much a male-dominated profession.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the fact that actually within a generation we've been able to move so far that mm-hmm. actually we've tipped the balance the other way is incredible.
So the opportunities for women have changed significantly too. Where would you like to see women in 100 years' time? I know it's a long time away and you and I won't be here, but now let's just take the next generation. Where would you like to see women getting their hands dirty in terms of different careers?
So I think one of the women that I follow on Instagram, her name's Anna Whitehouse, is flying the flag for flexible working.
Okay.
And the right for women to be able to essentially choose their hours that they work, because I think there's still this belief that unless you've got a bum on a seat in a 9-to-5 profession, Monday to Friday, that you're not offering anything to the workplace.
Yes.
So what I would like to see is that increased flexibility in workplace, more remote working, because actually, just because someone's got their bum in the seat 9-to-5 doesn't mean that's
productive. Even as a deputy head teacher, when I became a new father, I found it very challenging to be. I wanted to drop my son off at school. And yeah. I found the myths or the association that I was not lazy, maybe not committed, because I wanted to come in late once a week or something like that, because yeah. I had to do the school run. Yeah, and I know not every dad, or, you know, without getting all the bias and gender without stereotypes that I was talking about earlier, but the challenge, it's nice that we're talking about this a lot more in terms of flexible working yeah. for men and women.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else? Maybe let's fast forward 50, 100 years. Where would you like to see the female population?
That's a tricky question. I think when I'm just more women at the top of their game, really.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to... quick fire round. Give me three women you'd like to have around the table.
So, Michelle Obama, because I just think she's hugely inspirational.
Yeah.
Who else?
I'll give you some help. Sometimes people choose their grandmother or someone like that. Or
yeah, to be honest, I never met my I never met my father's mum, so that would probably have her. And also Karen Brady, which is unusual, but I do watch The Apprentice and I just love her work ethic.
She's admirable, yeah. And I imagine the challenges that she's faced in the football industry going back 20 plus years would have been very interesting. Yeah. What would be on the menu? What would be on the table?
So I like anything sort of Greek mezze style. So probably a Greek mezze starter and like a nice tagine for mains. And then dessert, it's chocolate fondant.
Okay, nice. what books are you reading at the moment?
So I'm actually just finished reading Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg, which is incredible, which actually I wish I'd had her on my dinner table.
Okay.
So Sheryl, she's the COO of Facebook, and she lost her husband quite suddenly a few years ago, and it's about how she's kind of picked herself up in the face of adversity, but incredibly, incredibly inspirational, incredibly moving. I actually listened to it as an audiobook, and by the time I got to work at the end of a particular chapter, I was in tears. It was
really
there's amazing. Something about someone narrating their own book.
Yeah, no, I listen to lots of audiobooks, and it's always someone else, and it's like not quite the same thing.
Exactly.
Can you tell me something you've learnt this week, or a light bulb moment that's made you think, oh, I need to do this differently? Or
yeah, I mean, it's kind of going back to my clinical practice that. I have a young boy that's on my caseload who struggles with ADHD. He really struggled over the summer holidays with his behaviour, and as a result was lashing out. There was police involvement, and I stuck to my guns and felt that actually I didn't need to change his medication, that I was confident that his behaviour deteriorating over the summer break was just down to lack of structure, lack of
summer
routine.
Slump, yeah.
Yeah. And I spoke to his mum earlier this week, and his behaviour has just completely turned around. I could have gone down what potentially some of my colleagues could have done, which is increase his medication, potentially change his medication in response to his behaviour, but actually allowing us to ride it out.
I find that fascinating because there's a lot of research about the summer slump, and I know Michael Gove, to quote the man, even coined the possible idea that summer holidays would be reduced, and there was a bit of an outcry from the teaching profession. But even my little boy, 7 years old, and even with the good security at home and the routines, they all went out the window and his behaviour changed. And now he's back into school a month in. He's back to that boy that we both know at home.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, and then, you know, even you meant talking about this case study, this young lad. It's refreshing and reassuring, actually.
Yeah, because I know that I had 4 weeks off before I started my consultant post, just because I didn't want to move from training right to my consultant job. Mm-hmm. And after a week, I really struggled because there was no sense of purpose. All routine was gone out the window. No structure to my day.
And some kids don't have anyone at home. Okay, so two last questions. Which woman would you recommend we interview next, and why?
Michelle Obama, if you can get her.
Okay, something more realistic. Well, fingers crossed, we'll try. Anyone in the medical profession in the UK, perhaps, that we could reach?
Do you know, that's a question I'm trying to think.
Or mental health specifically? one of your admirers.
I was going to say Natasha Devon, but you've already done
that. Yeah, all right. Well, that's the first person that we've managed to interview that's been mentioned on the podcast.
Oh, I'll have to get back to you, Olivia. I can't think of anyone.
Right, well, we'll add a sub-note to the recording. Okay, and where can readers find out more about you on Twitter, Instagram, website?
So my main platform is Instagram. I'm at The Mind Medic. I'm also on Twitter at Dr. Sarah Vora, and I've got a website, www.themindmedic.co.uk.
Okay,
but I share lots of practical tips and strategies. I call out headlines because I think sometimes mental health is misrepresented in the media.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Okay, great. It's lovely to meet you, Sarah, at last.
Good to meet you too.
Thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Teacher Toolkit. Find out more on our website and follow on social media using the usual hashtag TTKit100Woman. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to Teacher Toolkit. You can find out more about 100 years, 100 women on our website, teachertoolkit.co.uk, or follow us on social media using the hashtag TTKit100Women.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.